Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There is to be a balance on the earth of the eaters. One tiny fish dines on brine shrimp, and it's eaten by a larger fish that gets gobbled by a larger fish that is swallowed whole on up the chain and finally provided as bounty to the human species. It was the way things were. But over the past 50 years, whole strata of fish are missing in that chain, and it's causing calamitous repercussions. We tell the story of one such species, a legacy fish, whose plight is now in the hands of one American family. It's coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wildside News. The balance of nature is being shredded by the imbalance of power that has been unleashed upon the earth in recent years. Once, there was a will to protect the species and the endangered places. Now, there is a will to transfer the wealth in the hands of a few, and in the process, whole earthly systems are being wrenched and shattered. Does one family-owned company have the right to take until there is no more? Will there ever be again a will to balance? This particular show of the Wildside News is focused on the oceans. It's no secret to anybody who listens to this show and who pays attention to the news these days that the oceans are in crisis. But oftentimes it's very difficult to really get a sense of what that really means, to really understand the nature and the degree to which there has been this collapse. But joining me now is Bruce Franklin, who is an author and also was a teacher at Rutgers University in Newark, who has written a really fascinating article in this month's Mother Jones about an unusual fish species, menhaden, that probably a lot of people don't know about, except they may know it as other fish. He's really tracked the history of this fish from its beginnings and now all the way to its current status in the fisheries issues in the United States. Bruce, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sidney.
Tell us a little bit about menhaden and why this is such a fascinating fish to you.
Well, I think in order to sort of get your mind around this, you have to try to project back to the conditions of the ocean and the inshore waters along the Atlantic coast and the Gulf coast when Europeans first got here. I mean, they were absolutely awestruck by the fish that filled these waters, and giant fish. I mean, even when they were familiar with the species, they had never seen anything like this. But what was the main diet for most of these fish was this particular species, menhaden, which they didn't even recognize. I mean, the species wasn't even classified until really the second half of the 19th century. The fish, menhaden, were essential to all these other species, and this was realized finally in the 19th century. What they didn't know was the other ecological function that this particular fish has. Now, when I say this is essential to the diet of all the other fish and the predator fish, which are the main food fish and game fish and so forth, it's pretty clear. I mean, you can't really be certain about this, but it's pretty clear that at least half the fish on the East Coast and Gulf Coast were menhaden, this one particular species. That's by weight, by numbers, they were probably way more than half the number of the fish. I mean, they only go up to a little bit, about a pound, a little over sometimes. So that was one ecological function, was to feed the other fish. But where did the menhaden come from? What did they eat? I mean, people found out finally in the 19th century, yeah, they were eaten by all these other fish. What did they eat? What they eat is phytoplankton. They don't have any teeth. They swim in these unbelievably dense schools. I mean, when Europeans got here, I mean, sometimes these schools were just solid, and they were like that really until after World War II, and they swam through the bays and estuaries and inshore waters. You have to imagine, I mean, even today, we encounter schools that are as wide as a city block, as deep as a subway tunnel, totally packed, swimming with their mouths open, filtering the water, eating the algae. That's the phytoplankton.
They're plant eaters.
This is what this is what kept our bays and estuaries and other inshore waters healthy. What, since we've devastated the menhaden as well as the oysters, which is another story, we've encountered these toxic overgrowths of the algae, the phytoplankton, which result in massive fish kills and eventually the establishment of dead zones. The most extreme cases that we see are one in the Chesapeake Bay, which used to be the greatest source per acre of seafood in the world, I mean by far, which now has an annual dead zone which is increasing each year, expanding, so that in a whole vast area of the Chesapeake, below eight meters, there's essentially no oxygen or not enough oxygen for any animals or plants that need any significant amount of oxygen to live. In the Gulf of Mexico, we have the same phenomenon, a dead zone, which is as large as the entire Chesapeake Bay, which is a very large area, and which is also expanding annually. And this is a recent phenomenon. I mean, there are other contributing causes to this, and there's pollution. There's mainly the tremendous flow of excess nutrients that are coming in the Chesapeake, for example, through all the rivers that flow into the Chesapeake, and in the Gulf of Mexico, from the Mississippi and all its tributaries, which, you know, loaded up with agricultural fertilizers and so forth. But the reason that we have these overgrowths that lead to the blooms, the toxic blooms, and the dead zones, is because there's nothing there to stop them. Because we're wiping out this one species that was absolutely necessary to keep the waters from these toxic conditions. So, and yet, to really understand this, you have to see these two things are really very intimately related. That is, this unimaginable biomass of living animals that were out there for all the fish to eat came from this equally unimaginable quantity of phytoplankton that this particular species was eating. They are the animal version of these one-cell plants, most of the algae of one-cell plants, or combinations of cells.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's happened to the menhaden? Talk as if there's a serious decline. Why is there such a change now?
Well, it's a long and complicated story. I'm in the process of writing a book, which I call The Most Important Fish in the Sea, and so I'm tracing stage by stage what happened, and there was the discovery that menhaden could be used for oil as well as for fertilizer. We had the menhaden industry take over from the whaling industry beginning in the late 1850s, and by 1870 the whaling industry was quite insignificant, and the menhaden industry had taken over its place. People thought this fish was inexhaustible at the time. And so there was this wild overfishing. These were hundreds of factories strung out along the East Coast, hundreds of vessels, first sail ships and then steamships, scooping up whole schools of menhaden in a new, relatively new invention that they had in the 19th century called the purse seine, which could allow them to capture whole schools. And bit by bit, this devastated the great schools that migrated to the north. And Maine was where the biggest fish, where the most concentration of oil existed. Then you had a boom industry in Maine, and then a total collapse of menhaden in 1879 in Maine. And bit by bit, the range contracted, and the industry moved south and concentrated more and more in the Chesapeake Bay. And the menhaden, their fecundity, their ability to reproduce is so great that there were still these tremendous ocean schools out there, even though the range had contracted and the size had contracted. But then came, after World War II, you know, a great technological frenzy. I call it a techno-frenzy after the war. And the use of the airplane to spot the oceanic schools. And I was fortunate to find the first spotter pilot for the Menhaden industry, and he described the kinds of schools. He became very bitter and angry at what the industry had done in destroying the species. And so in the real boom years, the biggest catches were when they had all these rugged ocean-going vessels, which they got from the Navy after World War II, guided by spotter planes, able to find the great oceanic schools and destroy them.
So there was no opportunity for them to kind of hide or survive. Prior to this, these animals had a chance to survive because people had a hard time finding them.
Yeah, because they're very, very visible when they're inshore. I mean, uh-huh. You see them in a variety of ways. And one, it's a kind of dark purplish mass because they're packed solid. You can't believe how solid these fish are. And then because the predator fish are continually ravaging them, usually the school is marked by boiling clouds of birds overhead, gulls and terns. Ospreys, gannets in the fall, diving, crashing into the water. So it's not hard to see the school. And when they're in the few quiet moments when they're not being ravaged, they actually create an effect on the surface. It's like a hailstorm hitting the surface because the top layers swim very close to the surface, and their tails agitate the water, and they also do this thing called flipping, where a lot of them flip sideways out of the water. But when they're out in the ocean, of course, it's a lot harder to spot them, especially if you got a swell out there before the airplane came along. I mean, the ships had to have people up in the crow's nest, you know, like in the whale ships, to spot them. But even so, when the ship is in the bottom part of that swell, they can't see over the top. But the airplanes, I mean, they could spot them from 15, 20 miles away. Well, so there was no place left to hide.
One of the reasons for their demise is the fact that they're really not a fish that people eat. This is actually it's a crop fish. It's being raised for other purposes.
People need to understand that the main thing that's being done with these fish, and we're talking now about billions of fish a year, is grinding them up to feed to pigs and chickens and to turn it to pet food. And then the oil is used for industrial purposes like paints and linoleum and lipstick. There's nothing that this fish is being used for that it cannot be substituted for by something else which would not harm our ecology. And it is one company that's monopolized this industry. So it's one family really that's profiting from all this, and it's not even a very big company. So I mean, the whole thing is as irrational as you possibly could imagine. I think destroying the ecology for really no purpose but to pour money into the hands of a single family and provide a few hundred jobs in Virginia and maybe another 1,000 or 2,000 jobs on the Gulf Coast, and that's it. And those people who have those jobs could be doing other things in the marine environment.
The name of the company is Omega Protein. I think that all by itself says a lot, that it's so very specifically oriented towards its function. You know, that is a protein source.
Well, actually, I mean, they gave it that that name to make it sound like a health food company.
Huh.
And if you look at their propaganda online and so forth, it makes it sound like that's mainly what they do. And so if you go and get your omega-3 fatty oil supplement, you know, the health food store, you think that this is all coming from Menhaden. But on the other hand, if you look at their financial reports, you see that this is a totally insignificant part of their business.
At this point now, so the fish have been literally fished into, well, not extinction, but they're, in many areas, their populations have been significantly reduced. And in the Chesapeake Bay, where they kind of have their inholding, because they rely on the phytoplankton, they need that resource to feed, they're kind of holed up there, and that apparently is where omega protein is focusing its attention in terms of its catch.
Right. Well, they have in the Chesapeake Bay on Cockrell's Creek. This is where their big factory is. They've got a fleet of 10 ocean-going ships and a small fleet of airplanes, and they're hardly going out into the ocean at all. They're getting at least 70% of their catch out of the Chesapeake Bay now. And I mean, the Chesapeake is a disaster. I mean, it's not just the fishing of menhaden. Of course, there are other factors. I mean, there's the pollution, there's the pouring of excess nutrients into the Chesapeake, and also the fact that there's another example where there were all these warnings, and people said, you're overfishing. And, oh, no, they're inexhaustible oysters. Oysters, there used to be trains running every night from the Chesapeake to Chicago and New York and St. Louis, you know, loaded up with oysters from the Chesapeake. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were the other great filter of the mm-hmm. Menhaden swimming through the water, the oysters down on the bottom.
So that was like
totally
a complete...
wiped out the oyster population of the Chesapeake. Mm-hmm. It's now less than 1% mm-hmm. of what it was historically.
So therefore, with the Menhaden really decimated, as well as the oysters down to 1%, this filtering process in the bay is almost eliminated.
Yeah, you know, it's almost as though people decided, well, let's destroy this wonderful ecosystem. I mean, there was, you know, it was a fabulous ecosystem. When Europeans got here, you know, like Captain John Smith, you know, wrote about this. I mean, they couldn't believe what they saw in the Chesapeake. John Smith sailing his barge through the Chesapeake was going through solid masses of menhaden. He didn't know what they were. I mean, he didn't recognize the species, although he was very good at fish identification. I mean, they were so thick they tried to catch them with frying pans.
In the Chesapeake Bay right now with omega protein, what's the chance that there are going to be proper limits put on the extraction of the menhaden there? Because, you know, there's a lot of politics involved with all of these kinds of decisions.
Well, they sure are, and on the East Coast, there's a regulatory body called the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, the ASMFC, which has put limits on the amount that can be taken of every other fish. I mean, they usually divide the limit between the commercial and the recreational, and then there are all these fights and squabbles about different percentages. So, but there are limits on the catch. There is no limit on the menhaden catch. So this past summer, the ASMFC decided, well, they should try to put a limit on the catch from the Chesapeake, or they should consider this. And they were flooded with the most they've ever gotten, and letters and telegrams and people coming to speak at the open hearings and so forth. They had, you know, thousands and thousands of messages sent to them. And so finally they decided, okay, We're going to put a limit on the catch from the Chesapeake, and they put the limit at 110,000 tons a year. Well, this is really no limit at all, because this was the average catch of omega protein annually for the last 5 years. So, really, the limit was nothing more or less than a license to omega protein to keep doing what they're doing. Nevertheless, omega protein said, you can't do this to us. We're going to go to the Virginia legislature, because the Virginia legislature has to implement the limit. So they went to the Virginia legislature, and they own enough of the people in that legislature. So even though three different bills were introduced in committee to implement the ASMFC limit, all three were torpedoed. So right now, we're in this kind of limbo where the legislature has refused to act. The newly elected governor, Kane, does have the authority to implement that cap, to lift that limit. But I think it's extremely unlikely that he would do that, because as you say, Sydney, it's a political issue. And so that will leave Virginia in out and out defiance of the ASMFC, and I don't think this has ever happened before. How this is going to play out, I think will depend to a very large extent on public awareness of the issue and what people do about it. Because, yes, it's a political issue, and therefore, because it's a political issue, people can have a great deal of influence on the outcome of the issue.
Well, sort of two questions. One, assuming that the limits aren't effectively enforced or reduced, actually, what is the projected consequences in the bay itself?
First of all, you can already see what's happening in the bay. We have a very striking example of what can be done when we come to our senses and actually do something to protect an endangered species, and that is striped bass. It's kind of the signature species of Chesapeake Bay, and very important species on the East Coast, as well as the West Coast, where it was transplanted. So striped bass on the East Coast looked like they were doomed. And then we did come to our senses. We put in a moratorium. There's still a federal ban on fishing for them outside the three-mile limit. And lo and behold, the striped bass came back, you know, miraculously. I mean, it's just been wonderful how they've managed to come back. But striped bass depend on menhaden. It's really the one species that's going to give them the high lipid count that they need, right? The oil that striped bass need for energy and to develop properly. So because of the deprivation of the menhaden in Chesapeake Bay, the striped bass are all malnourished. And I had heard both sides of this. That is, I heard from people, you know, fishing in the bay for striped bass, saying that they were sick and malnourished, and there were horrible diseases and so forth. And I heard from Omega Protein saying, "Oh no, everything's well. You know, the striped bass are just doing fine." So I decided to see for myself. I went down there this past summer and fished with Jim Price, who's a charter boat captain, a fifth generation waterman, and two marine biologists from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, and we went out and fished the striped bass. And I'm used to seeing a lot of striped bass. I've, you know, caught quite a few in and around the New Jersey, New York area. I was so shocked and disgusted by what I saw that night, because every striped bass we caught, except one, was obviously diseased. They had these red sores that were eating into their flesh, so the parts of the fish sometimes were just eaten away by the disease. And the one fish that we caught that didn't have any obvious signs of disease, I mean, it looked healthy enough superficially, you took another look at it, you realized it was pathetically skinny. And, you know, why are these fish sick? I mean, it's the same reason that a human population gets diseased when they don't have enough to eat. Malnutrition leads to vulnerability to disease. I mean, I think it's that simple.
The story that you're telling is just one of many in terms of these unique dynamics between industry and corporations and people who are making money and the populations of animals. It's happening all over the world. What can we learn from this particular dynamic, and what do you see as the future? Where do you see this going?
I think that's a really good question, or really two questions, both very good. I think one of the reasons that I think this is the most important fish in the sea, why I use that term, is because this confronts us with the most clear choice to make. Because, you know, with other species, you say, well, you know, what people need food, you know, what are we going to do if we don't catch these fish, you know, what are we going to eat, blah, blah, blah. But we're not eating the menhaden. They're full of, they're too full of bones. There's hardly any flesh on them. They're very oily. They smell terrible and so forth. So there's no rational reason for us to be doing it to this species. So if we cannot comprehend that and do something about it, I think this is the real test case for our intelligence and ability and will to do something to address the collapse of the marine environment. And then the second part of the question is what's the prognosis here? I think that it follows, you know, directly from what I just said. The prognosis depends upon what people do. That if people do become aware of this, do see the necessity to exert our human will on the situation and to stop the destruction of the environment, then we could have a happy ending to the story. If we don't, I think the outlook is very ominous, very grim indeed.
For people who would like to learn more about this and to become more involved, how can they do so?
I think the first thing to do is simply to get informed on it. And I think people could really ought to take a look at this latest issue of Mother Jones. I mean, not just because it's, you know, my article would say it's there, but I think the whole issue, which is primarily an oceans issue, is extremely helpful in presenting things in a way that people can understand and do something about. And then the next thing I think is to get involved politically, especially as far as this particular species, in the areas where it's really going to count. I mean, for people in Virginia in particular, secondly in North Carolina as far as the East Coast goes, and then in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas as far as the Gulf Coast goes. But I think the Magnuson Act is up for renewal. There are going to be big fishery issues politically, so it's not just a local or regional issue. These are all national issues. I think that if people get informed and it becomes clear to our politicians that there are a lot of votes on one side and very few votes on the other side, even if the omega protein and the other corporations that are destroying the environment contribute, you know, to their campaigns, I think they might go for where the votes are and do the right thing. And it wouldn't be the first time. There's a fine book by Dick Russell called Striper Wars, which is about what I was talking about earlier about the saving of the stripers, which gives a number of examples of how that issue was fought out and how people did become aware and active and change political reality. In New Jersey, where I live, the fight on this particular species, menhaden, has been going on for over 120 years. I mean, in 1882, the legislature banned the fishing for menhaden with purse seines in New Jersey waters, and the governor vetoed it. That was 1882. We didn't get the law passed until 2001. When we did get it passed, we see a spectacular difference, not just in the population of menhaden in New Jersey waters, but also these very valuable fish that feed on them, especially the striped bass, the bluefish, and the weakfish. I mean, that's very striking. And anybody who's out there fishing sees it.
You've really made your case that this is one primary example of where science and reality makes its point so clearly that we should, if we're intelligent beings, make wise decisions based on those realities. Otherwise, this incredible collapse is going to continue and we're all going to suffer as a result. So Bruce Franklin, I want to thank you for giving your thoughts here on the Wild Side News, and we'll keep in touch and try to keep people informed.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Sydney.
Somehow, things have to change. You can read more of the details about omega protein and the menhaden in the March-April edition
of Mother Jones Magazine. Reporting about nature. It's one of the few sources we have into the stories we need to know. What's happening in science and ocean reporting? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.